This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
In no particular order on the program today, electric cars, garbage, and oh yeah, the unemployment report. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 4th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I don't know about you, but I, for one, am ready for a nice quiet August news-wise. Before we get there, though, we got to figure out what happened this past week. Catherine Rempel is at the Washington Post. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Catherine, let's take a quick pass through the jobs numbers, if we could, just as a way to get going. 209,000 new jobs. The rate falls to 4.3%. My question to you on this Friday, almost 10 years after the financial crisis, is, are we back now? Can we say we're back?
We are back in terms of the number of jobs. And actually, the Hamilton Project at Brookings puts out this monthly report analysis thing where they look at the size of the jobs gap, which is how many jobs we should have when you adjust for demographics, et cetera, if we were to be back where we were when the recession began. And actually, in July, it was the first month that the answer to that was yes. So in terms of jobs level, again, adjusted for demographics, we are back where we started. But that doesn't mean people feel the same because of wages and things like that.
Right. So what else do you think, Sudeep, needs to happen besides jobs to get us feel? And I get that this is a very big question in 4 minutes of radio. How do we get back to where everybody feels all right? It's wages.
You got to spike the punch bowl. You got some. You have to have something else
okay,
in there. Econ nerds just love talking about these numbers, but they're just not connecting with people. It doesn't feel like an exciting recovery, maybe because wage growth is okay but not great. We just haven't revved up in a way that makes it feel like we've taken off. But also, that lack of excitement is also a good sign for the duration of the expansion, because usually when these things fall apart is when it feels like a party, when people are a little too excited, and that's when you should be nervous. So maybe this points to the durability and the duration of the recovery being a bit longer than usual.
So slow and steady is good, right? Is that what you're saying, Sudeep?
In this case, could be the silver lining to it.
Yeah. All right. So, Catherine, August, we were talking before the gong went that we're all a little worn out news-wise, and in theory, August is going to be quiet. When Congress and the White House come back, though, discussion will turn to tax reform, among a bunch of other things. I want to know from you, which is going to be harder, do you think? Was health care harder, or is tax reform going to be harder?
If we're talking tax reform,
yeah,
emphasis
word.
On the second word yep. there, that's going to be very, very difficult. I mean, we haven't done this in 30 years, right? And there's a reason for that. Mm-hmm. It's because actually reforming the tax code means simplifying it. It means bringing down the rates and closing loopholes. But for every loophole, there is a constituency who wants to keep that loophole. So the politics of that, even when you have a functional government, which I would not argue we have right now, are very, very difficult. If we're talking tax cuts, which just means, you know what, lower the rates, forget all the loophole stuff, forget all the simplification stuff, just like take the top number and bring it down. That's a little bit easier. I think there's some support, even among Democrats, for example, reducing the top corporate tax rate. So if we were to scale back our ambitions and say we're only going to bite off corporate taxes, we're only going to change rates, that's a little bit easier to accomplish. But again, not a done deal.
Right. No, of course not. Speaking of scaling back ambitions, Sudeep, first of all, your thoughts on tax reform versus health care, but also the end of September, at which point the government will have, or the Congress and the president will have to agree on a debt limit increase and a new budget for the coming fiscal year, is going to be desperately ugly.
Desperately ugly is a good phrase for it. Tax reform is a once-in-a-generation moment. It doesn't feel like this is one of those times when you get a once in a generation moment where all the stars align for a big overhaul of tax policy. We seem to be having difficulty doing some small stuff, and that nothing has really changed over the last few years. Being able to prevent a debt default and raising the debt ceiling, preventing a government shutdown, those are all things that Republicans have been fighting for the last decade. Now that they control the Congress and the White House, are they really going to just change their tune entirely? We don't really see a whole lot of signs of that, and that should make people a little bit nervous as you get into September. That the stars haven't aligned for the basic stuff, so they're certainly not aligning for the big stuff.
Yeah, let me save you a click. They are not actually going to change their tune. Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Quick bit of news from the Wall Street Crime Blotter before we move on. Martin Shkreli, best known perhaps for having raised the price on a critical drug that his firm Turing Pharmaceuticals controlled, raising that by 5,000%, was convicted on unrelated charges of securities fraud today. Shkreli, who you might have seen referred to as the Pharma Bro, was convicted on 3 of 8 counts involving a couple of hedge funds he ran. Sentencing TBD. Elsewhere in the beating heart of American capitalism, it was fine up. But just fine. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let's be real clear here, shall we? This was a good jobs report, a really good jobs report, in fact. However, comma, as with almost all things economic, it was not all sunshine and light. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill takes us to the dark side.
Sorry to play spoiler, to rain on the bright and shiny economic parade going on today. But if you dig deep into the jobs report, one of the fastest growing parts of the job market is the one that pays the least.
One of the leading sectors that added the most number of jobs was the food and beverage services and drinking places.
William Rogers is an economist at Rutgers University. Those new restaurant and bar jobs made up about a quarter of the total number of jobs created in July. They pay about $331 a week. An average weekly paycheck for a private sector job is more like $745. Nicole Smith is an economist at Georgetown University. She says there are a couple ways to look at the bounce in hospitality jobs.
So on the one hand, you can think of the growth of that as an indicator of confidence in the economy.
More of us are going out, paying someone else to pour us a beer. On the other hand, for some folks working these jobs,
it can be difficult if there's no place for you to go. There's no chance at upward mobility.
There's a broader economic implication of a growing number of low-paid jobs. Slow wage growth overall. Jed Kolko is chief economist at Indeed.com.
Faster growth of lower wage industries brings down the overall average of wages.
It's not the only explanation, he says, but one to keep in mind. Even if it does bring you down from your jobs report high. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We did a story the other day about Detroit, the big three car makers having come upon a rough patch, 7 straight months of falling sales. For the first time in almost a decade, in fact, the Japanese are selling more cars in this country than Detroit is. Which gets us to the manufacturing news of the week. Toyota and Mazda said today they're going to build a $1.6 billion plant in the U.S. in the next couple of years. An interesting partnership choice for Toyota, which has long relied on its very safe and very big American business. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath has the story.
Toyota and Mazda are taking a traditional approach to their partnership. Rather than just agreeing to build a plant together, Toyota's showing its commitment by taking a 5% stake in Mazda.
It's pretty much a promise, maybe a little bit more than a promise, that they're going to stay with each other.
Dave Sullivan of research firm Auto Pacific says Toyota is worth almost 20 times what Mazda is. So what's in it for Toyota? Sullivan says the company's known for making reliable, commodity cars. But Mazda...
Mazda has cars that have personality. They make the front-wheel drive, fun-to-drive cars. They have a lot more spunk in them than a lot of the competition.
Auto analyst Stephanie Brinley at IHS Market says that's nice, but not critical to Toyota's business.
I think for Mazda, it's a much bigger move for them.
Mazda builds most of its cars in Japan today. And Brinley says with a U.S. presence, not only will it cut down on costs, it'll be less sensitive to volatile currency fluctuations with the yen. Rumor has it the companies will be working together on electric vehicles at the new plant. At an earlier press conference about their partnership, the company's two leaders stood side by side. Toyota's CEO, Akio Toyoda, answered speculation about a fuel cell vehicle being the first product of the new marriage. Here he is, speaking through an interpreter.
I mean, I really want this car. I want the baby that we are going to have to be that car.
Congratulations to the happy couple. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
There are 8.5 million people living in New York City. Between them and all the commuters and the tourists as well, they generate a whole lot of stuff. A lot of money and profit, sure. A lot of noise, yes. Also, trash. Trash that's expensive to get rid of and that the city would very much like to find a cheaper way to deal with. There is a plan afoot, but it would mean some big changes, as Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
An orange-vested sanitation worker hauls two bulging, smelly trash bags from the sidewalk in Brooklyn into the back of a truck. Then all that garbage is crunched down, and they're off to the next block. The city's sanitation department says New Yorkers only recycle 17% of their household waste on average. Rhea Unjuin is originally from South Korea, where recycling laws are quite strict. But she admits that here in New York, if she's feeling lazy or in a hurry, she just throws everything in the trash.
But I should recycle better after talking to you.
The low level of recycling in the city is a problem because carting all that trash to landfills takes a lot of resources. Catherine Garcia is New York City Sanitation Commissioner.
There's nothing inexpensive about moving waste in the city of New York. It costs us about $300 million a year for our final disposal.
Local landfills have filled up, so New Yorkers' garbage gets hauled upstate and to states as far away as Virginia and South Carolina that have agreed to accept it for a fee, which is why the city is working with a Michigan firm to come up with a plan that might persuade New Yorkers to recycle and compost more. Antonio Reynoso is a New York City councilman from Brooklyn.
And what we've known always works, no matter where you are, is through either incentivizing or fining. One or the other always works.
He says the city would prefer to use a carrot rather than a stick. Now, it's hard to get people to change their habits. The city is rolling out composting in more and more neighborhoods because much of the waste we produce is food. About a quarter of the city's residents can compost at the moment. Garcia says some new residents are especially keen.
Because we have such a very large immigrant community, many actually in their home countries did this.
The sanitation department has noticed high participation rates among immigrants from several Asian countries. But in my Brooklyn apartment building, the compost bin in the basement is rarely half full. The ick factor and the effort of taking chicken bones and soggy vegetables downstairs seems to be too much for most people. There's also the question of how you make a plan like this, where each household is held responsible for its output, work in a city where two-thirds of the residents are renters. Nicole Gelinas is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute.
Technology may be giving us ways to do this more accurately, and it should be revisited that people could be given bags with barcodes within their buildings or have a sticker with their apartment number in the building.
A sticker you could scan so that load is attributed to a particular apartment. Reynoso says any new garbage plan will cause some people to grumble, but he says New Yorkers will be more upset if nothing changes.
The thing here is that your taxes are going to continue to go up constantly so long as we don't do something about the way we handle trash. It might be the most expensive thing we do in the city of New York in 20, 30 years.
500,000 people have moved to the city in the last 10 years and more are coming. The population is expected to hit 9 million by 2040. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Yeah, I'm in a helicopter.
Yeah, it wasn't me. Electric cars and a power grid adventure. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 0.3% on this Friday, 66 points, closed to 22,092. NASDAQ up 0.1%, 11.6351. S&P 500 gained 0.1%, 4 points, 24.76. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up about 1.2%, the NASDAQ down 0.4%. S&P 500 ended the week with a gain of 0.2%. Shares of Blue Apron took a hit today, ending down 6.2% on word that the meal kit delivery company is going to relocate 1,200 employees. Its New Jersey facility, apparently, is moving to a different location some 15 miles away. Elsewhere in food delivery, Grubhub up 9% and behemoth Amazon essentially unchanged. As we told you earlier, Japanese car makers once again selling more cars than Detroit in the American market. Toyota up 0.8%. Mazda revved up 2.8% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.26%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Mitchell Hartman was telling us yesterday about a growing labor shortage amid the boom times in Bend, Oregon. There is another element to the geography of the American labor market, though, that people who are looking for work aren't necessarily in the same cities as the jobs are. In his interview with the Wall Street Journal last month, the full transcript of which was published by Politico, President Trump flat out said people are going to have to start moving to where the jobs are if they want to find work. Heather Long wrote a piece for The Washington Post pointing out that the president is right on this one. Heather, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kai.
Do me a favor, would you, and tell me why it's bad that people aren't moving around in this economy anymore?
Well, you want your workers to be where they're most needed and where they can feel the most fulfilled and hopefully create the technologies and the new products of tomorrow. And at the moment, we seem to have this problem in the United States where there's job openings in certain parts of the country, but the workers seem to be living in other parts of the country.
And what do we know about why people aren't moving? I mean, as you said in your piece, the president said the other day, you know, people are just going to have to start moving. It's easier said than done, right?
It's incredibly easier said than done. There's the obvious financial factors that we can all think of. I just moved from New York City to Washington, D.C. It costs money to do that. You have to pay the movers. If you own a house somewhere, you have to sell that house. And so if you're in an area that's economically depressed, you have to sell your home, and then there may not be somebody to buy that. So the president just said, well, they should just leave it, accept the loss, and go. Well, that's not realistic for every family. But there's also cultural factors. And in the reporting that I've done, and the Wall Street Journal had a good piece this week, when you go out and you actually talk to people about why they're not moving, it's often, I don't want to leave my family and friends. I'm scared of that big of a bigger city or a different place. Maybe the crime rate's higher there, or people won't like me, or they won't think like me.
This is perhaps taking it to too far an extreme, but if everybody in, the parts of southeastern Ohio or Kentucky where there aren't a whole lot of jobs moves to one of the coasts where there are more jobs nowadays, that kind of depopulates big chunks of this country.
You're right. It would be very different what the fabric of America looks like. It would also, and some people have pointed this out, if you take some particularly young workers, people 20s, 30s, 40s, and they left those areas, if the most talented people in some of those small towns left, it's going to be even worse for the people who stay behind. So that is a conundrum.
So what are we supposed to do with this? I mean, knowing it is one thing and then being able to find some kind of solution is entirely another. And the president of the United States just saying they're going to have to start moving and take the loss on their house isn't going to do it.
Yeah, he sort of wants to do a PR campaign, and I think it's going to take a lot more than that. There's a huge debate about whether we should try to actually pay people to move, maybe give them a little bit more help. There is a tax break you can claim at the moment, but it's not very much money to begin with. Some people also say, okay, why aren't businesses paying? If all these CEOs are around the country saying, I can't find the workers that I want, why aren't they actually going out and then helping to pay some people to incentivize them to move?
And pay them more, just full stop, right? When those
jobs
that
would probably help a little bit too. But I will say this, one of the more interesting pieces of research I've seen is a study that showed that 6 months after people take a big leap in life, so usually something like a move, they're usually happier. So they usually feel better off. So we see all this anxiety, financial, cultural, or otherwise, about making a big life decision. But actually, when people do it, they usually do find themselves happier and more fulfilled.
Heather Long at the Washington Post. Heather, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
On the theory that business and the economy are sometimes a little bit opaque, we do a series every month called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Your questions, our answers. Today's question comes to us from Chris Linden of Crystal Lake, Illinois.
I have always wondered, does an electric car actually create less pollution and conserve resources, or am I simply substituting one form of pollution and resources, like fuel exhaust, for another, like power plant exhaust?
We put our sustainability reporter Jed Kim on this one.
The most accurate answer to Chris's question is, it depends. So I needed him to answer some questions about his question.
Well, this is Chris.
Chris Linden is a writer in an outer suburb of Chicago. He drives about an hour to get to work. His car?
A 2010 Toyota Corolla.
Not an electric, not a hybrid.
A regular old internal combustion engine.
He's toyed with the idea of an electric car, but how bright does the green halo on them really glow? Your question, Chris, is why some people refer to electric vehicles not as EVs, but as EEVs.
Elsewhere emissions vehicles.
Kevin Book is managing director of Clearview Energy Partners. He says how clean an electric car is depends on where you plug it in.
Different states have different generation mixes. Different local sources of power create different impacts.
In Los Angeles, where I live and work, the energy mix is pretty green. The city's Department of Water and Power took me on a ride to see that for myself.
Yeah, I'm in a helicopter.
Yeah, it's cool. Thanks, Chris, for your question that got me up here. Flying for 40 minutes northeast of L.A., we get to the Beacon Solar Farm, a massive array of black glass grids spreading out over the sand.
I'm flying over the Mojave Desert, and this gigantic solar farm, renewable energy sources like this, really cut down on the emissions that come from power sources.
So when you plug your electric car into a grid that's clean, the car is clean. And we saw several solar farms on our flight. Helicopter pilot Jeff Goldman's noticed the growth in the 2 years he's been flying for LADWP.
There's definitely more solar farms going up. You can see they're actually being worked on out there. I saw a few extra patches, dirt patches popping up where I'm going to put more panels down.
LADWP gets a quarter of its power from renewable sources. It expects to get a third by 2030. LA already has about 27,000 electric cars on the road. But this is California, early adopter of pretty much all things green. In Illinois, Chris, a company called ComEd provides your power. Last year, it only got 2% of its power from wind, 0% from solar, 35% came from coal. So get an EV and plug it in there, and some coal gets burned, and emissions result. And Clearview's Kevin Book says if that coal plant is old and inefficient, the emissions from the plant itself are actually slightly higher than driving a typical 30-mile-per-gallon gas-powered car. But the past decade has seen a lot of renewables come online. Cleaner natural gas has boomed, and newer coal plants burn cleaner.
Today, the average power generation mix is a lot greener than when it was more coal-intensive. And as a result, you have less than half the carbon intensity.
So on average, no matter where you are, driving an electric car would shrink your emissions footprint by at least half compared to your Corolla. Plus, electric vehicles are getting more efficient, traveling further on less power, so
the days of the elsewhere emissions vehicle, here in the United States at least, are for the most part over.
So there's your answer, Chris. Here's a little extra, though. It comes from J.R. DeShazo, who researches public policy at UCLA. DeShazo points out that the emissions that come out of tailpipes and power plants contain more than just carbon dioxide. There's also ozone, tiny particulate matter, carbon monoxide.
And those cause asthma, respiratory disease, heart disease in individuals. And just reducing people's exposure to those emissions improves their health.
Electric cars don't emit those pollutants. That's another factor to consider in measuring how clean EVs make the air. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Who got the ride in a helicopter? We kind of need your questions to make this whole idea work. Send them along, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out from the annals of rebranding, Dunkin' Donuts is trying something new. They're going to open a store in Pasadena, California, to be called simply Dunkin'. Apparently the chain wants to be known more for its coffee than for its donuts. Fine. Brancaccio on the Morning Report today pointed out that KFC used to be Kentucky Fried Chicken and 3M started as Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing. Other examples? AARP decided American Association of Retired Persons sounded too old, I guess. Also, once upon a time, NPR was National Public Radio. Don't get me started on that whole APM thing. All right, we're out of here on a Friday. The Dow up 0.3%. Today, 66 points. NASDAQ up a tenth, 11 points, 63.51 there. The S&P 500 up a tenth, about 4 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you on Monday. This, well, you know the rest, right?
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.